as we relaunch the Hal Turner Show in a more positive vein, a more professional atmosphere, I am pleased and honored to welcome to the Turner Radio Network my first guest. His name may be familiar to many of you. His name is Mark Weber, and he is with the Institute for Historical Review. Mark, welcome to the Hal Turner Show.
Thanks, Hal. It's a pleasure to be on. I'm honored especially to be on the relaunching of your show this evening.
Well, I'm glad to have you. And I've got to tell you, I have never been very big individually in revisionist history. I've been aware of revisionist historians. I know simply by common sense that history is written by the victors, and what they write is not necessarily accurate, such is the case apparently with World War II. So if you would, for folks like me who may not be completely familiar with the Institute for Historical Review, why don't you give us a little idea of what you folks are about?
You know, I think I can make it very relevant for a lot of your listeners. Last June, President Bush criticized those people who were skeptical about his claim that the war against Iraq was necessary because the Iraq regime of Saddam Hussein had dangerous arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. And he responded to that by saying that those people who are critical or skeptical, he calls them, he said, they're revisionist historians. Now, Bush doesn't always get things right. In fact, often he gets things wrong. But in this case, he was in an unintentionally correct. That is, those people who were skeptical and who of his claims about these weapons of mass destruction are revisionists. And what revisionism is, in its essence, is skepticism about official and dogmatic history. That's really all it is. Above all, revisionists are critical or skeptical of official views about the past, because without a realistic, truthful view of the past and the present, no society is able to make policies for the future that make any sense. It's essential to understand the past in order to understand the present and the future. And that's what the Institute for Historical Review tries to do.
I'll tell you,
much of what the IHR is famous or infamous for is its dealing with World War II history, and above all, the Holocaust story. Now, that's what we're in the news a lot for. That's what we're most often criticized for. Now, I don't want to get right now, unless you want to later, into the whole ins and outs of all of that. But suffice it to say, we deal with the Holocaust issue as much as we do because it's the most important historical icon, dogma of our time. You know, in some countries, Hal, it's a crime to express a skeptical view of the Holocaust story. It's the only chapter of history that is treated in that way. And in our society, we have a U.S. government agency called the United States Holocaust Memorial Council, dedicated to upholding forever the memory of non-Americans victimized by other non-Americans in Europe, that is, Jews in World War II. We have a huge museum in Washington, and we're inundated, I mean, over the years, with a flood of motion pictures, newspaper articles, magazine articles, books, and so forth, to focus attention on this one particular chapter of history. Now, we believe, and the reason we deal with this issue so much is because the Holocaust story plays this great role in our society socially, culturally, politically.
Well, I got to tell you, one of the things that the left wing in America has done quite successfully over the years is they've managed to change the meaning of words. Words mean things, and if two people are going to have a conversation, they need to agree on a basic set of facts. And generally, the language has been the facts that people agree on before they even begin a debate. It seems to me that calling oneself a revisionist lends credence to the notion that history somehow needs to be revised. It seems to me that if it was the Institute for Historical Accuracy, it would go farther than the Institute for Historical Review. But that's just a perception thing.
I understand your point. Just about everyone is in favor of historical review and in revising history to bring it in accord with new information and new insights. You know, after the Soviet Union fell apart, after the end of communism in Eastern Europe, the textbooks throughout Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union were rewritten. History was revised. Official history was revised and done away with. But you're old enough to know, your listeners are old enough to know, that even in our country, here in the United States of America, the history of our own country has changed over our lifetime. How we view the role of American Indians in American life has changed. How we view many chapters of American history has changed. That's part of life. That happens all the time. The question is the view of history that we hear an accurate one? Is it a true one? And is it in accord with the facts and our insights? Now, history is, in wartime, is most often written by the victors.
Yes.
And obviously, governments or victorious powers have an interest in presenting the past in accord with their own interests, with their own perspective. And people should be on guard for that because, obviously, people will bend history and are understanding the past for their own interests, and that's all it means. Revisionism just means, comes from the Latin, it means to look again, to take another look at the past based on information, new information, and new insights.
Well, Mark, I'll tell you, I am 42 years old. I was raised Irish Catholic. I lived in the suburbs outside of New York City. I went to public school, and as I was brought up in what was predominantly white Christian America, I was taught from a small child on that World War II was a terrible thing, that Nazi Germany tried to take over the world, and that as part of what they did, they rounded up all the Jews and wanted to systematically destroy them. And I remember as a child in grammar school seeing 16-millimeter films in class with these bodies, emaciated bodies in pits and mass graves, and this was told to me that the Nazis did this and they attacked the Jews because they were Jews. And I grew up believing this, hook, line, and sinker. It was only about 3 years ago that I started waking up to some realities. One of the realities is that in war, people die, and that in World War II, Germany had been so crushed, so blown apart, they couldn't move food, they couldn't move fuel. In war, people get taken prisoner, or people get rounded up, as we did here in the United States with the Japanese. If they can't get food to the camps that the people are in, the people starve. That's not systematic destruction. That's just a hard fact of life. And it seems to me that the more I look into this story of World War II, of what Germany was accused of trying to do versus what others have taught me was actually the case, and what the Jews claim happened to them in World War II versus what seems to actually have happened, there is like a diametric opposition between the reality and the facts and the claims.
Well, a few points about just to touch on a few points you raised. First of all, everyone's familiar, of course, with the pictures of the emaciated corpses, the dead and dying people taken at camps that were liberated by American and British soldiers at the end of the World War II, especially Bergen-Belsen, Dachau. These pictures, of course, are very familiar. They're, of course, grim, awful, horrific, but the context is removed from these pictures so that the reality of why these people were dying, why they were starving, is left out. And listeners of your show are invited to check on our website, ihr.org, click on any number of subject headings using the search engine. You'll find a whole lot of information about that. But the central point here is that the history of World War II, the presentation of World War II, and the presentation of so much else in our history is PC. That is, it conforms to a kind of official view of the good guys and bad guys in history. In our own lifetime, the role of all sorts of people in our own history has changed. Was Abraham Lincoln a good guy or a bad guy? He was a bad guy, I guess, because he was a racist. Was George Washington a bad guy or a good guy? Well, a black high school in New Orleans changed his name from George Washington to, I think, Martin Luther King because George Washington was a slaveholder. Was he a bad guy or a good guy? How we look at the past is determined by the political forces and social forces of the present. And that's true not only of World War II history, it's also true of Middle East history. It's true of other chapters of history as well. There's a few things about the thing called the Holocaust. Up until the late 1970s, the word wasn't even in popular usage. You didn't find encyclopedia articles under the heading of Holocaust until the late 70s, early 1980s. It's taken on an iconic, dogmatic status that it didn't have during the 1940s or 50s or up until the 60s. And in fact, for many people, World War II has now become a conflict revolving around what happened to Europe's Jews during that era. In fact, during the war itself, what happened to the Jews in Europe was a very minor part of it. That's why.
Let me jump in here a second, just for please. This is a point that hit me like a sledgehammer not too long ago. You know, 100 million people died in World War II. Why is it that we only pay attention to the alleged 6 million and the other 93 million don't seem to count?
Well, if you ask the average American how many Jews were killed in World War II, almost as a reflex, people say 6 million.
Correct.
But these same Americans have no idea how many Americans, British, Germans, Poles, French, Chinese, Japanese, or any other nationality died or were killed in World War II. You know, it's surprising for a lot of people to know that the number of Chinese civilians killed in World War II, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, is 20 million. We don't hear about endlessly about the 20 million, but we hear endlessly about the 6 million. This is this disproportion, this standard represents the kind of values and so forth in our society. But most importantly, as I've stressed over and over, it's a crime in some countries to dispute this one chapter of history. And in the United States, although it's not a crime, it's not very healthy for your career if you publicly say that you are skeptical of Holocaust claims and the Holocaust story.
Well, I'll tell you, I can tell. I have firsthand experience at what happens to a person's career when they start to buck the status quo and start asking questions that other people find uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I was a real estate agent with Coldwell Banker Commercial. I made lots of money. All of a sudden, I was given a choice. Either I was going to be a radio host with my website and radio show, or I was going to be a real estate agent, because the two had become incompatible. And when I said, wait a minute, I never mentioned my real estate career or the company I work for on my radio show or my website. The two things are separate. I'm an independent contractor for Coldwell Banker. You cannot tell me what I can do in my personal private life. They said, you're right. We can't tell you what you can do in your personal private life, but you are an independent contractor, and we can terminate independent contractors at will. So you choose. Do you want to be a real estate agent, or do you want to talk on the radio? And I chose the radio.
The double standard that you're talking about is also illustrated by something that's happening just in the past week with our own institute. We have a display advertisement in the current May 3rd issue of The Nation. The Nation is a well-known, venerable American public affairs intellectual weekly.
Yes.
And it has a circulation of something like 160,000. We have an ad in the current issue for a book we published called The Founding Myth of Modern Israel.
And I'm going to ask you to hold it right there, hold that thought, because we've got to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we'll talk about what happened with the Institute's ad in The Nation. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Hal Turner Show. The telephone number to dial if you'd like to talk to me or Mark Weber, 201-348-8449. We'll be back. You're listening to The Hal Turner Show live from Metropolitan New York, New York. And if my guest, Mark Weber from the Institute for Historical Review, hasn't collapsed from that song, hopefully he's still with us. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am here, Hal.
I didn't plan that. that's a song that's in there from the old lineup, and, well, I think I'm going to have to rotate that out.
Yes, I think that would be a good idea.
All right. I apologize if it was a little on the over-the-top side, but I'll be more careful for the rest of the show. We were talking about an ad that the Institute for Historical Review had placed in the May 3rd issue of The Nation magazine. What happened?
Well, in short, all hell broke loose. Jewish groups complained. The ad, advertising for The Nation, had been solicited by The Nation. We didn't approach them. They approached us. We sent in the ad. We contracted to run it 6 times. It's a 1/8 page display ad. And after it appeared, the first I learned about it was a news release or a press release from the David Wyman Holocaust Institute, which claimed that, thanks to their efforts, the Nation had adopted a new policy of not permitting advertising by what they called Holocaust deniers. Well, this was news to us. I called and asked what the policy was, what had happened. and I was informed that the ad would not be appearing in any future or subsequent issues of the magazine. And I asked why, and I was told, well, the ad was contained information that was not true. I said, well, what in the ad is not true? And I was not able then, and since then, to be given a clear answer to that question. Last Friday, supposedly, an editorial meeting is taking place at the magazine to iron out exactly what the policy is. Now, what's interesting, there's several interesting things about this thing. One of them is in the very same issue of The Nation, two pages later in the same issue, is an advertisement for a booklet that claims to offer what it calls incontrovertible proof that Jesus never existed.
No.
Now, I said, is the Nation policy, Nation magazine advertising policy to permit what might be called Jesus denial advertising, but not, as it were, Holocaust denial advertising? Well, what I'm trying to do is to show the hypocrisy, show the double standard here, and to show what really is at stake here is not what's false or untrue or true or what free speech is going on. I'm trying to show that what really is happening is a caving in to pressure from Jewish Zionist groups.
Yes.
The Anti-Defamation League immediately issued a statement, a letter by its director, Abe Foxman, in which she began the letter by saying, what was The Nation thinking when it accepted this ad? Well, indeed, because The Nation didn't quite get the word that advertising like that is simply not permissible in our society. And that this whole incident points up what the limits of free speech are in our society. When they begin to collide with Jewish Zionist interests or what they're perceived as Jewish Zionist interests, they're not permitted. And that's what's been, and the double standard here in The Nation, which is remarkably more tolerant or more freewheeling than many other periodicals, shows the limits even for that periodical.
Well, you know, it's interesting because a person once said to me, no matter where you travel in the world, whether you speak the language or not, the way you know who runs a country is based upon who you cannot talk about. You could go from America to Rome, and depending upon who you can't talk about, if you raise a subject and the people go, that's who's running the country. And I find that to be remarkably sage in its factual basis.
Well, I would put it, I agree. I put it another way. You can tell the real hierarchy of power and interest in a society by looking at what's forbidden. That's,
yes.
That's another way to put it.
Okay, simple.
And as I say, as this thing shows, in our society, Jesus denial, or put it another way, to offend the sensibilities of Christians or of many other groups in our society is considered, well, fair game. That's the way it goes. You got to live with it. That's too bad. Be tolerant. Sit back. That's what America's all about. That's what we're told. But the same standard does not apply when it comes to Jewish and Zionist interests. Then a whole new standard comes in. Oh, that's offensive. Oh, that would insult the memory of the dead or some such thing. Well, these same standards do not apply across the board. And the hypocrisy in this matter points up the real hierarchy of power and of values in our society, I think.
No doubt about it. The question becomes then, how did a group of people with this particular set of goals or values or this particular perception of history achieve the level of control that is clearly the case now in the United States if they are in fact such a minority? And to me, the easiest answer is control of the media.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, listeners who are interested in this will find a lot more on this subject on the IHR website. If you type in Jewish power or Zionist lobby or some such, you'll find a good bit of material on the IHR site and on other sites that are linked to ours. But there's no question about this power. But even acknowledging this power is practically taboo in our society. You know, a few months ago, a congressman from Northern Virginia, Tom Moran,
yes,
made a statement. He simply said to a group of people in a small gathering that if Jews had not supported this war in Iraq, there wouldn't be a war.
That's right.
And this thing was immediately broadcast around the world. Tom Wren was forced to recant. And since then, efforts have been made to remove him from any kind of influence within the Congress for having made this remark. But the fact, the reality of what I call Jewish Zionist power in our society is an obvious one, obvious to everyone in the world. Obvious to, in fact, it's so obvious that even people who deny that it exists have to operate as if it does exist.
Yeah.
I go into this in some detail in an essay I wrote called A Look at the Powerful Jewish Lobby, which you can download from our website. It's an essay also that's been put on quite a few other websites as well. Bishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa, he said about 2 years ago, he said, the Israeli government is placed on a pedestal in the U.S., and to criticize it is to be immediately dubbed anti-Semitic. People are scared in this country to say wrong is wrong because the Jewish lobby is powerful, very powerful, unquote. Well, that's just an obvious truism to people who look at the situation, I think, objectively. But but Americans have a hard time understanding or accepting this, I think, because to accept that is to accept that something is really out of kilter in our society. Now, the reason, I think, that this particular lobby is so powerful is because Jews in general have a very, very high sense of collective group interests in a country in which everyone else is encouraged to think of themselves only as individuals. When in a society in which the great majority of people have no or are encouraged not to have any collective or group interests, another group, even if it's a very small one, as Jews are in our society, that has a very strong sense of its own interests and its own identity, that group can wield immense power, vastly out of proportion to its numbers. And I think that's what's happening here in the United States. Now, there's any number of Jewish writers, Jewish commentators, who have themselves acknowledged the extent, the scope of this tremendous power. But the important thing is not that this particular group or that particular group is powerful, but that it wields power for interests that are not the same as others. They're Jewish interests. They're Zionist interests. Those interests are not identical with the interests of other people. And that's reflected, I think, most strikingly in the case of this U.S. special alliance with Israel. It's an alliance that most of the world understands is a perversion of the values that we as Americans claim to uphold.
Well, let me jump in here for a second and speak to that issue. I was a staunch believer in the past that Israel was our only ally in the Middle East. Poor little Israel had a right to defend itself from those maniac terrorists. And I come to realize that the problems of the Middle East all flow from Israel. From the very beginning of the creation of this so-called state that was taken, that resulted in the taking of land from people who had been on that land for generations, simply a declaration by the United Nations that certain amount of land would be carved up in a certain way and given to these Jewish people, and that the folks on that land were driven off, were not being compensated at all for their land, for their homes, for the things that they lost, and that basically set the stage for generation after generation of fighting, because the folks that were dispossessed had a beef with the folks who took the land. And when I understood this reality, then I began to pay attention to things like who attacked who first, who retaliated, and how the media covered it. And time and again, the Israelis would take action against Palestinians, like bulldozing homes, bulldozing shopping centers, seizing property. And it was after that that some action would happen, a bomb would blow up, or someone was shot. But the way the media portrayed it was an Arab terrorist attacked poor Israel. That wasn't the case. It was retaliation for what Israel had done.
Well, I want to. This is especially important with regard to the work of the IHR, because how we look at the Middle East comes from our understanding of the history of that whole thing. I'm a bit older than you. When I was young, I, like the vast majority of Americans, was very strongly pro-Israel. But my view of the Israel-Palestine or the Jewish-Arab conflict in the Middle East was formed very much by such things as the motion picture Exodus.
Well, I'll tell you what. Hold that thought. It's the bottom of the hour. We have to take another quick timeout. I promise. No more surprise commercials, no more surprise songs. I made double sure at the last time. So if you just hang in there a second, I can get a drink of water. You can get a drink of water. I'll give the number 201-348-8449. It's the Hal Turner Show. I'll be back. And I'm back. Hal Turner live from New York, New York, USA on the Turner Radio Network. The telephone number that you can dial if you'd like to call in and speak to me or Mark Weber, my guest from the Institute for Historical Review, is 201-348-8449. Mark, are you still there?
Yes, I am, Hal.
All right. Sorry to have interrupted. We were talking about the state of Israel and how the Palestinian conflict, how you learned about it.
How we look at the past, because how we look at the past determines how we look at the present and the future. And I was saying that when I was young, I, like almost all Americans, was very pro-Israel. And my view of that was not a very deep one, but I was influenced, like many people were, by this motion picture Exodus, which came out, I think, about 1960-61.
Okay.
Well, I've learned since then, it's essentially a cartoon. It's an absolutely pro-Zionist view of the conflict, of the whole background of the thing. And anyone who has studied, who knows anything really about the Middle East, pretty quickly learns that this cartoon-like, simplistic view that we were taught when we were young in the United States about that whole situation is wrong. It's misleading. It's inaccurate. And out of that inaccurate view of the past comes a foreign policy which I think has led directly to the loss of American life and the terrible conflict we now find ourselves involved in the Middle East. But I want to go back a ways. In 1948, there was a important debate in the highest levels of the U.S. government about America's policy toward this new state called Israel that was founded, declared in May 1948. The Secretary of State at that time, George C. Marshall, the Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal, the head of the State Department Planning Section, George Kennan, the specialist, the highest chief in the State Department for Middle East Affairs, all urged President Truman not even to recognize the State of Israel. They warned that to recognize and support the State of Israel would harm American interests and would get America involved into endless conflict and endless strife in that part of the world. And President Truman made a fateful decision. The decision was, because of Jewish Zionist interest here in the United States, which were important politically to him and his party, he decided to support the State of Israel. That is, he put, as George Marshall said, he put narrow political interests ahead of American interests and much less the interests of humanity in deciding to support the State of Israel in 1948. And since that time, every subsequent American president has essentially made the same choice. He's put the interests of his party or of his own political life ahead of the interests of the American people. And the result has been countless billions of dollars squandered or expended to support the State of Israel and the loss of American lives, and the increasing disdain of the world for the United States as a result of all of this. So much so that on the Middle East, and especially on the Israel-Palestine issue, the United States of America is now virtually alone in the world.
I ran for the Republican nomination to the United States House of Representatives for the 13th Congressional District of New Jersey back in the year 2000. And during that foray into politics, I came to learn something very important. As you know, we, America, spend several billion dollars a year in foreign aid, loan guarantees, and military assistance to the State of Israel. What I came to find out is that as those billions get sent overseas to Israel, Israel takes the money and it moves through the various organs of government over there, and a funny thing happens. Groups with Israeli interests here in the United States, pro-Israel lobbies, pro-Israel political action committees, they suddenly find their coffers swelling up with money. And this money is used to aid the reelection campaigns of the people who voted to send the money to Israel. Frankly, Mark, in my personal opinion, a sizable chunk of the foreign aid sent to Israel by the United States is laundered by the Israeli government, sent back to the United States in the form of contributions to political action committees, with the wink and a nod understanding that those committees will support the members of Congress and the members of Senate and the presidential candidate who understands what's going on and will keep the money flowing to Israel. I believe, in my personal opinion, that this is a giant money laundering operation, and if you follow the money, it starts to make sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'll find a great deal about how this all works politically in our society on our website, and also the website, other websites too, including, I would recommend highly, the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. But if you go onto IHR.org and go onto the links, you'll find a lot of information like this. But it's interesting, I'm glad you brought this up, because in January, I attended a large rally here in Southern California of AIPAC. AIPAC is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It's widely regarded as the single most powerful lobby organization on Capitol Hill. It's the central lobbying organization for Israel by Jewish Zionist groups here in this country. And I went to this meeting. It was a public meeting, although there were a few non-Jews in the meeting. Overwhelmingly, it was a Jewish meeting. In fact, it was at a synagogue. The main speaker was the local congressman, United States congressman for this district, Chris Cox, who represents this area, including Newport Beach, where the meeting was held.
Yes.
Now, I've been to other Israeli or Zionist meetings before, but it's worthwhile going because it's a real eye-opening experience, I think, for the average American. What comes out, what comes across very strongly at meetings like this is just how determined, how resolute Jews are in their support for Israel and their determination to make sure that U.S. congressmen are in line when it comes to their interests, Israel interests and Jewish interests here in this country. And that came out very strongly in this meeting. In fact, one of the points made strongly at this meeting by the speakers there was that the United States now is the only country in the world which reliably can be depended upon to support Israel and its policies, especially the policies of the Sharon government, which have earned the disdain and the contempt of most of the world. But the importance of AIPAC in this regard was emphasized because AIPAC keeps the United States Congress in line. And if the U.S. Congress is not kept in line, voting for billions of your taxpayer, our taxpayer dollars for Israel, Israel is in great trouble indeed, because its great bastion of support is the United States, and I would say the befuddled, misled American voters. Now, the congressmen and the politicians and senators in Washington, they understand very well how this works, and they know that their political careers are ruined if they don't stay in line. Now, there's around the world a greater awareness of how all of this operates, but in this meeting here at AIPAC, what I think how it operates is a bit differently than that. American Jews give tremendous amounts of money to AIPAC and the Jewish lobby to keep the United States for Israel. And then, in return, what happens is that this is paid off in the form of American taxpayer dollars, which then go to Israel. I mean, to me, the hypocrisy of this whole meeting and this whole thing is pointed up by the fact that here at this meeting were 800, 900 Jews from Southern California who are all eager and fervent in their support for what they call this Jewish state in the Middle East for other Jews. But none of them seem very interested in actually moving to this state of Israel. And they want other people to move there. If the state of Israel is really all that it's supposed to be, first and foremost, those people who support it, who are Jews, ought to go live there if they think it's such a wonderful idea, because that's the whole promise and goal of the state of Israel, is that Jews should live in a Jewish state. But you cannot have a situation, ultimately, where people have, a powerful group has a loyalty that's first and foremost to a foreign country, and expect everybody forever just to tolerate a situation like that, especially if it gets America involved in wars and conflicts that take the lives of our people and hurt our interests.
What I find amazing is when I hear political candidates like, well, George W. Bush and John Kerry actually stand up and say Israel's interests are the United States' interests.
Well, the situation is so ludicrous. Some months ago, George W. Bush declared called Ariel Sharon a man of peace. You know, that's pretty amazing. Not even in Israel do people call him a man of peace. John Kerry has said during the last several months that if he's elected president, he'll be even more pro-Israel than George W. Bush. I keep thinking, what does that consist of? Writing even a bigger blank check of support. Because George Bush's policies represent not only a break even with the kind of tepid U.S. Policy in the past of a kind of settlement, a peaceful settlement of this conflict. It represents a sharp rebuke of world opinion, of international law, even of American law, by the way. Much of what Israel does is even contrary to American law. And when American politicians voice their support for Israel in the way that they have, they're in effect putting the interests of a foreign state above the interests and the good of our own country. I'll give an example of that. At our last conference, 4 years ago, at the 13th IHR conference, one of our speakers was a former U.S. Congressman, Pete McCloskey, who represented Northern California at one time. In 1982, he spoke out on the floor of the Congress against Israel's use of cluster bombs supplied by the United States in the invasion of Lebanon. Now, apart from the fact that the invasion of Lebanon itself was deceitful and illegal, the use by Israel of cluster bombs in that conflict was a violation of American law, because those bombs had been supplied to Israel on condition they be used only for defensive purposes. At first, Israel denied that it was even using cluster bombs, but Pete McCloskey said that people in the State Department who knew the truth told him that he was right on target and he should keep protesting it. Finally, Israel admitted that it was using these cluster bombs. Now, instead of being supported by the other members of Congress and the U.S. Senate for pointing out this violation of American law, Pete McCloskey was shunned and criticized by the other members of Congress because he dared point out this blatant violation of American law by our so-called ally in the Middle East. And this is a remarkable thing, because it shows the extent to which, it really shows the extent of corruption of our political system. When our political leaders put the interests of a foreign state, of a foreign interest, ahead of the interests of America and even of American law.
Well, here's an interesting thought I had, I guess it was sometime last year. The First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States says the United States Congress cannot establish a religion. Yet how many times do we sit and listen as U.S. congressmen, senators, even the president say that Israel must maintain a uniquely Jewish character? Is it not a violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States for the United States to be supporting a specific religion, be it here in the United States or anywhere else?
Well, if a foreign country wants to set up its own religious standards, that's its business. But it shouldn't ask and demand that the American public subsidize it, especially when the cost is such a high one for the American people. You know, just a few weeks ago, George Bush expressed his support, gave a green light for the building of these settlements on the so-called West Bank.
Yes.
The amazing thing about these settlements, these are for Jews only. They're Jew-only settlements. If the United States supported such a policy in any other country, it would be roundly, soundly denounced.
Well, I'll tell you, Mark, we need to take another break. Let me ask you to hold on, and we'll pick it up when we get back. Folks, you're listening to the Hal Turner Show live from New York, New York, USA. I'll be right back. And I'm back. Hal Turner. My guest tonight for the full 2 hours, Mr. Mark Weber, is with the Institute for Historical Review. We're talking about the harsh realities of political life, social life, cultural life here in the United States, and how a small group of people is having a disproportionately large interest or effect on the United States. And, Mark, thanks for hanging on.
You're welcome.
We were talking about if the United States said that they wanted to support new developments, new settlements in any country other than Israel, and in that country other than Israel, those settlements would be for a specific race or a specific religion, there would be outcry from all over the country and all over the world. Yet, when this exact situation happens with Israel,
Let's suppose, for example, Ireland, to name a country with which you have some ancestral tie, were to declare that certain parts of the country reserved only for Catholics.
There'd be outrage.
It'd be outrage. Oh. It'd be considered absolutely outrageous.
Sure.
Much less settlements on land that's taken by force illegally from another people, for heaven's sakes. It's unbelievable. What it does is make America look like a country of hypocrisy, that all of its supposed support for democracy and justice and rights is really can't. It's just a lot of hot air. That what really matters in America is power and interests, and especially the power of a small minority, which has the grip that it does in our political, social, and cultural life, notably in our media.
Which brings us to a fascinating piece that I read on the National Alliance website, Who Rules America? And it discusses at length who owns the most influential media outlets in the United States, and how it comes down to a very small group of people, most of whom have one thing in common. They're Jewish. You know, at Nuremberg, after World War II, Julius Streicher was hanged by his neck until he was dead, even though he was not in the German military. He was not an elected politician in Germany. He published a newspaper. And yet they convicted him of alleged war crimes and executed him. Since that time, it seems very clear to me that the folks who felt the brunt of media criticism made it a point in their lives to make sure that no one would ever be able to control media anywhere again. Is that about right?
Well, I made the point that Julius Streicher was hanged for publishing a newspaper that, if he had published it here in the United States, would be legal and protected under the American Constitution. That's pretty astonishing, to hang a man, not for what he's actually done in any action, but for what he says or for what he writes. I mean, there's a lot of things that people find offensive, but that should not be the criteria of whether a person is punished or jailed or imprisoned or fined, much less hanged.
Right.
That thing was pointed up again by the whole controversy in recent months over this film, The Passion of the Christ, by Mel Gibson. Jewish groups strongly denounced the film, called it anti-Semitic, called a lot of other things. Offensive and so on and so forth. Well, a lot of motion pictures have come out of Hollywood in the last 20, 30 years that are offensive to a lot of people. But Jewish groups didn't mount this enormous campaign against any of those films, but they have mounted this campaign against this film. But the success of this film, I think, points up a couple of things. First of all, it shows that as great as it is, Jewish Zionist power in the United States is not limitless. It does have bounds.
Yep.
It is possible to speak out against it, as you are showing here this evening on this broadcast.
Yes.
In fact, in that regard, the Internet has been an enormously liberating influence in our culture.
Yes.
Because it permits information and opinion to be passed around the world to large numbers of people, bypassing the usual gatekeepers, mediators, who have had such a grip in our media and cultural life. But it does show again this just how it points up the kind of media problem that we're talking about here.
Now, a very small group of persons. Let's just talk about one. Sumner Redstone, whose actual birth name I think was Murray Rothstein. He owns Viacom. Viacom owns Paramount. It owns Blockbuster Video. It owns a host of some of the biggest entertainment and media companies in the United States. And sitting atop this media empire is a man who seems to feel it's okay to show on MTV whites and blacks dancing together, specifically blonde-haired, blue-eyed white girls dancing with African-American males, and all sorts of trash that goes along with that type of thinking, which is resulting in cultural decay and societal breakdown in our country. Yet if I was to point out that the folks who control the media are, in fact, all of a single group, they all share a common thread, I would be called an anti-Semite. I would be called anti-Jew. So the truth is now referred to as hateful, because you're not supposed to observe certain truths. You're not supposed to speak about certain truths. It's the most frightening change in America that I've seen in my 42 years on this earth.
Yeah. You know, in a book entitled The Jews in the New American Scene, written by two Jewish writers, Seymour Lipset and Earl Robb, they wrote this, quote, "During the last three decades, Jews in the United States have made up 50% of the top 200 intellectuals, 20% of professors at the leading universities, 40% of partners in the leading law firms in New York and Washington, 59%, that is a majority, of the directors, writers, and producers of the 50 top-grossing motion pictures from 1965 to 1982, and 58% of directors, writers, and producers in two or more primetime television series." The other day I was reading the memoir of Max Frankel. He was, from 1986 to 1994, executive editor of the New York Times. His memoir came out in 1999. It's entitled The Times of My Life and My Life with the Times. And in this book, here's what he writes, and I think you'll find this interesting. Quote, "Instead of idols and passions, I worshipped words and argument, becoming part of an unashamedly Jewish verbal invasion of American culture. It was especially satisfying to realize the wildest fantasies of the world's anti-Semites. Inspired by our heritage as keepers of the book, creators of law, and storytellers supreme, Jews in America did finally achieve a disproportionate influence in universities and in all media of communication." He goes on to write, "Punch Sulzberger," that's Arthur Ochs Sulzberger, publisher of the New York Times,
"yes,
unconsciously abetted this movement. Within a few years of Punch's ascendancy, there came a time when not only the executive editor, A.M. Rosenthal, and I, but all the top editors listed on the paper's masthead were Jews. Over vodka in the publisher's back room, this was occasionally mentioned as an impolitic condition, but it was altered only gradually without any affirmative action on behalf of Christians." He goes on to write, "American Jews use their political clout to defend Israel's intransigence. Democrats especially depended heavily on Jewish money, which was offered them at early and decisive moments of every political season. They also depended on the concentrated voting power of Jews in the largest states. But Jewish support was firmly tied to Israel's interests. Even fervent friends of Israel, like George McGovern and Ed Muskie, used to complain to me during their campaigns for president that they had to clear their statements on the Middle East with Jewish censors. Although the purchase of influence is a common feature of American politics, I found it disheartening to see Jewish organizations spending their influence uncritically on behalf of every twist and turn of Israeli policy," unquote. Now, to me, there's two points in this thing that leap out at me in this memoir. One of them is what he calls the Jewish verbal invasion of American culture. That's a pretty startling phrase.
It certainly is.
And it's one that Max Frankel is a man who doesn't say things lightly or just to hear himself speak. And the second phrase was that, as he mentions, is the word censor. That is, Jewish censors had to clear, that's his word, clear their statements on the Middle East, even with American political leaders such as George McGovern and Ed Muskie, who were pro-Israel. It wasn't enough that they were pro-Israel. Every statement, their statements have to be vetted, have to be cleared by what he calls Jewish censors before the American people even hear them.
That is...
Now, that's a remarkable grip on our political and cultural life and on our media.
It certainly is.
If any other group in American life had that kind of control, that kind of grip, the American people would rightly be outraged. But when it's the grip is so great that even criticizing it is considered out of bounds in our society.
And again, it falls back to, you know who's in charge based on who you can't talk about. Let me ask you, you had a conference out in California recently, didn't you?
Yes. On Saturday, we organized a conference in the aftermath of the wreckage of a conference that was to be held in Sacramento, California.
Please tell us.
The original two-day conference was canceled, and at the urging of some people who were attending or planning to attend the conference and didn't want their tickets and so forth to go to waste, there was a lot of pleas to for us to do something to try to salvage what we could of the thing. So,
let me jump in here a second. Why don't you tell me what the first conference was scheduled, where it was scheduled to be at, what it was scheduled for, and what happened to wreck it?
The original conference was a two-day affair, April 24th and 25th, in Sacramento. And I was to be one of the speakers, but we were not organizers of the event. A contract had been made for the event to be held at a German-American cultural center in Sacramento. And then 4 or 5 days before the event was to begin, the center canceled its contract and said that the event would not be permitted there. The organizer then sent out an email message saying the whole event had been canceled. Apparently he didn't have a backup, or at least didn't have a backup that he used, and told people to cancel their hotels and travel plans. Well, we jumped in, and we organized in the aftermath of that a one-day conference. About 130 people attended in Sacramento at another site. We were able to, with help from local people, get a local site. We're here in Southern California. Sacramento's in the north. And the event came off well. Now, one of the fears that we had was that the Jewish Defense League, which is a very fervently Zionist organization with a long record of criminal and even terrorist activity, had threatened to disrupt the event. And that's why we went through some rigmarole to try to keep the site secret and to organize it that way. But again, that's part of the reality of our society, is that even a peaceful meeting like this is can be threatened by a group with a well-documented record as a criminal group with the Jewish Defense League.
Now, let me ask you, if the Anti-Defamation League or the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, Public Affairs Committee, well, let's use AIPAC, because AIPAC is having a big meeting this month, right?
Right.
And as a matter of fact, Ariel Sharon might be attending this meeting of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, in or around Washington, D.C. If the Hal Turner Show made some sort of a declaration that it was going to do something to disrupt their meeting, the Hal Turner Show would be swamped with law enforcement. Why is it that when your meeting gets threatened, nobody wants to hear about it?
Yeah.
And I'll pose that question as we take this brief time out. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to open the phone lines. And I ask you to call. The number to dial, 201-348-8449. My guest is Mark Weber from the Institute for Historical Review. We'll be back right after this. So, I pose the question, if it is not okay for Hal Turner's show to threaten to disrupt or hint that he's going to disrupt something, then how is it that a group like the JDL can hint or threaten or outright disrupt a meeting such as the one you were planning to attend and get away with it?
In fact, in the opening remarks that after the MC spoke, I made some brief opening remarks, and I quoted from an article that had appeared in the newspaper that very morning about this meeting. And in that article, the reporter for the local Sacramento Bee, it's the main daily newspaper there, said that the meeting was being held at an undisclosed site because of the controversial nature of what was being discussed. And I said, well, that's just out and out wrong. That's just not true. And the media doesn't really care if it's true. It's not being held at an undisclosed location because the subject matter is controversial. It's being held in an undisclosed location because a Zionist group is threatening to disrupt it, because they're threatening violence against the meeting. That's why it's being held under the circumstances it is. But the Sacramento Bee, like much of the media, is less concerned about the threats by a group like the Jewish Defense League, with a, as I said, with a long record of criminal activity, than it is about a peaceful meeting by our group, by people who are speaking completely in accord with our Constitution and the law.
So ultimately, the first conference was destroyed, or is wrecked, or is disrupted.
Right, and so we held this other conference, and it went well. It started a little after noon on Saturday, and it went to about 9:30 in the evening with breaks throughout the day and a large break for dinner. And I said there was about 130 people of all ages, infants to old people, and it was it went well.
And,
you know, much more important than the meeting itself, or more important than the meeting it was for those who attended, many, many, many times that number have heard the talks and addresses at the meeting on the Internet. And there was a special website set up just for the meeting, and it's under internationalrevisionistconference.com. And those people who go to the IHR website, if they go onto the homepage, they'll see all the information, and they can listen to the talks, download them audio from the website that's dedicated to the conference.
Well, I hope that folks who are listening to the program will visit your website. And I don't know if you guys do link exchanges or things like that, but I'd certainly be willing to put a graphic up on my website for your site if you think you might be willing to reciprocate.
Well, thank you. Okay. But the conference went well. The first main speaker was a man from Canada, Paul Fromm, who heads the Canadian Association for Free Expression. And he spoke for about an hour about the case of Ernst Zundel. And it's a matter I'm pretty familiar with. I've known Ernst Zundel for some time. And for the past year, I have appeared on quite a few radio and television shows, or mainly radio, talking about the injustice against Ernst Zundel. Now, many of your listeners may not know or care very much about this, but Ernst Zundel is a German-American who has been a target for Jewish Zionist groups in Canada for disputing the Holocaust story. And he's been held now for more than a year in a Canadian prison as a so-called threat to national security on what all objective viewers of the situation say is a pretext. It's a trumped-up thing. And I don't say that lightly. The leading newspaper in Canada, the most influential daily, the Globe and Mail, published an editorial just a couple of months ago in which it affirmed that the case against Ernst Zundel is an empty one, that it's an injustice being carried out against him, and that, in fact, holding Ernst Zundel in this way is a danger, a threat to the rights of all Canadian citizens.
Now, I'm told that a judge from Canada is going to sit and talk about this in some upcoming hearing?
Yes. Remarkably, a judge in Canada is going to be testifying on behalf of Zundel in this matter as a defense witness in this case. And it's a remarkable thing. Very rarely do judges ever testify in other cases, but he feels so strongly that this treatment of Ernst Zundel is an injustice that he's expressed his willingness to testify on his behalf.
Mark, let me jump in here and talk to you briefly about something that happened here where I live outside of New York City last October 3rd and relate it to the Ernst Zundel case. Last year, about the summertime, a group calling itself the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride organized busloads of illegal aliens to travel from about the 10 largest cities in America to a rally at Liberty State Park in Jersey City, New Jersey, on Friday, October 3rd. They brought 10 busloads from around the country. There were additional people that came, you know, with those buses. I'm sorry, but it wasn't 10 busloads. It was buses from 10 cities. About 1,500 illegal aliens arrived at Liberty State Park in Jersey City, New Jersey, at the invitation of New Jersey's Governor James McGreevy. As this event was being promoted, I personally spoke about it on this radio show, and I personally contacted the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Department of Homeland Security, Immigration and Customs Services Security. I contacted the White House. I contacted members of Congress, the Senate. Nobody would lift a finger to stop these 1,500 illegal aliens from gathering in Liberty State Park in Jersey City, New Jersey. And their intention and their stated goal was to use the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island as their backdrop to demand amnesty from America's immigration laws and the ability to get driver's licenses and a whole host of other things to make their existence in this country more smooth. When I realized I wasn't going to get anywhere with Department of Homeland Security, etc., I organized a counter rally. I had less than 100 people there. Mark, do you know which group was surrounded by New Jersey State Troopers?
Well, let me take a big leaping guess there, Hal.
Wasn't the 1,500 illegal aliens.
Mm-hmm.
It was me and my 50 or 60 counter-demonstrators.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, Ernst Zundel, an individual, a single individual, who allegedly missed a single immigration hearing, is swarmed upon by immigration officials, taken into custody, and swiftly deported from the country.
Well, I'm glad to see how that you're familiar with some of, at least some of the background to this case. That's right. He was arrested at his home in Tennessee. But one thing you left out that's pretty pertinent is that he was arrested in spite of the fact that he's married to an American citizen. That's especially unusual. And then he's been held, after he was taken over the border into Canada, for more than a year in solitary confinement in a cell in which the light is never turned off, not permitted even to have pens. He has to use a pencil to write. This is just simply outrageous. He's been held under these circumstances for more than a year on the pretext, and I use that word really advisedly, the empty pretext that he's a threat to national security. And as I said, independent observers of this thing have confirmed that the pretext under which he's being held is really bogus. One of the interesting things that's also come out in recent months are documents that show collusion between American and Canadian officials to get Ernst Zundel. Now, the important thing is this. Ernst Zundel is really in jail now and has been targeted because Jewish Zionist groups in Canada don't like him. They hate him. They want to shut him up. They want to put him away in jail. And they do so because he has published things that they regard as harmful to their interests. And the treatment of Ernst Zundel points up, once again, this kind of double standard that exists not only in United States society, but also in Canada as well.
Now, I understand the situation in Canada is they are looking to deport him as a state threat or a threat to state security and send him to Germany?
Well, the danger is that regardless of the outcome of hearings that are now taking place in Canada to determine if he's a so-called threat to national security, the danger is because he's a German national, a German citizen, that he'll be put on a plane and sent to Germany where he faces up to 5 years imprisonment for violating the anti-free speech laws in that country that make it a crime to publicly dispute the Holocaust story.
But he didn't do that in Germany.
That's right. Well, they contend that he mailed things from Canada to Germany that constitute a violation of that law.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing, too, isn't it? I mean, imagine, for example, if someone sent literature from the United States to someone in China that said that communism is not a good system, and then took a trip to China and then was thrown into jail in that country for 5 years. I mean, again, if the standards that are applied in this case were standards applied in other cases, the outcry against the injustice against Ernst Zundel would be universal.
Yeah, and it's just it's mind-boggling because all these situations lead us back to, in whose interest is it that this thing happens?
Yes.
In whose interest is it, for instance, that these illegal aliens are allowed to flood across the border, travel at the invitation of a state governor to Liberty State Park in Jersey City, and rally in front of the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island in full view of federal, state, and local authorities and not be touched? And at the same point, at the same time, or in a similar time frame, a fellow like Ernst Zundel, who talks about what he talks about, finds himself forcibly seized, almost instantly deported, and thrown in jail for a year. In whose interest is it that these things happen? Well, it would have to be in the interest, in the illegal immigrant case, of somebody who wants to pollute, destroy, break up, weaken white Christian America. And in the Zundel case, it's someone who doesn't like what he's saying. Who fits the bill in both cases?
Well, the IHR doesn't really get involved in the immigration issue. That's not really our issue. But we are concerned about free speech, and we're especially concerned about free speech when it has to do with issues of history. And that's why we have a special interest in the Zundel matter, because he was arrested and put on trial in two spectacular court cases in the 1980s in Canada for reprinting, for publishing a booklet called Did 6 Million Really Die? I testified in 1988 for 5 days in the 1988 trial, and I also testified later in one of the hearings subsequently. But the result, the upshot of the 1985 and 1988 cases in Canada was that the case went all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court, and ultimately the Canadian Supreme Court vindicated Zundel's arguments by throwing out the law under which he had been convicted as unconstitutional, as a violation of Canadians, Canada's so-called Charter of Rights. Now, that is a victory for the liberty of all Canadians. And in that regard, Zundel deserves a kind of gratitude from Canadians for having done that. But I was simply astonished that after winning this battle, which permitted the free publication of this booklet, Did 6 Million Really Die in Canada, the same Jewish groups that wanted to get him for that then turned around and began a whole new legal proceeding against Zundel because this same booklet and some other Holocaust or revisionist items were on a website in the United States. In other words, something that in Canada was legal in printed form, Jewish groups were trying to get Zundel punished for having on the Internet, for heaven's sake.
I know, and he foolishly went to that trial. Tell you what, we need to take a quick break, and then we're going to go to the telephone. So, folks, now's the time to pick up the phone and dial 201-348-8449. That's 201-348-8449. This is the Hal Turner Show. My guest, Mark Weber from the Institute for Historical Review. We'll be back. What are the Institute's immediate goals for the future, either for advertising, public relations, meetings, or, you know, do you do leafleting? How do you encourage people to get involved with what you do?
The IHR does a lot of things. We publish books. We've temporarily suspended publication of our journal. But the biggest way we reach people is by far through the Internet. We're very happy that during this past month of April, the traffic, the hits on our website have been at an all-time high. In fact, in January, February, March, the traffic, the number of hits on our website has increased almost double during that period of time. And the IHR website is now something like one of the top 1% of websites visited in the world. There's also been a tremendous amount of traffic and hits on the International Revisionistconference.com site, which was dedicated to the conference that we had on Saturday, the 24th of April. But that's, an important way. Also, I do radio interviews and other interviews on a pretty regular basis. Although this is, it's not usual that I am on for 2 hours as a guest. Of course, I alluded to earlier, we had this CAM ad in the Nation. It's important, really, to reach new people and not just reach the same people who might already agree with us.
Sure.
And that's why we're going to be expanding this ad campaign to other periodicals, and we have some other ideas in mind about this as well. We also hold meetings and conferences. We held a couple of I spoke at a couple of meetings last December. Of course, we just had the recent conference I told you about. We've held 14 full-scale IHR conferences over the years, and we'll probably be holding another meeting later this year with British historian David Irving.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, this caller on hold, how about we switch gears a little bit, jump off to the telephone, see what the public is thinking,
great.
And then if more calls come in, we can stay with that. If not, we can go back to chatting between yourself
right.
and I.
Okay,
great. Hold on. Hi, you're on the Hal Turner Show. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hal, it's G.L. Baldy down here. I talked to you Sunday.
Yes, sir.
And I told you I couldn't afford, but by golly, I can't afford not to join up. I can't afford not to join up, for I love you. I think the world knows you, and I love Mona, and I want to be able to catch Mona tonight. So I'm on the air now?
Yes, you're on the air with me and Mark Weber.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm pleased to be there, and people that don't join up are fools, for they're going to miss something awesome. They don't want to get your show, but I think the couch potato is awesome, and your whole lineup is.
Do you have a question for Mark Weber?
No, not particularly. Well, I've got a card here I want to give to you privately.
Well, sir, you'll have to give a call back after we go off the air at 11 o'clock Eastern time.
Well, if I give it to you at that time, how quick can you get me on?
Instantly.
Oh, buddy, that'll work.
All right, then.
I'll be calling you at 11:00 sharp.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
All right, Mark, I'm sorry about that. You know what it is? I just switched to a new subscription program. For 3.5 years, I gave away this program for free on the Internet. And I got to tell you, in its heyday, I had 20,000 listeners.
Wow.
And which is more, incidentally, than many small-town radio stations in America.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got sick last year, and I was on, I was off, I was on, I was off, and my listenership dropped down from 20,000 to a few thousand to a few hundred, and, you know, I'm in the process of rebuilding. One of the big things that it took to keep this thing going was to pay for bandwidth. Every person who listens on the Internet costs me bandwidth. And
right.
I have to pay for that. And I was getting bills like $8,000 a month. So, you know, I wasn't the richest guy in the world anymore because I had no real estate job. So I had to make some changes. And today was the first day that we implemented this new system where people can listen for free, but there's a very small number that can listen for free. And the rest will have to pay 50 cents a day to get in and listen. The idea being that if people want to listen, they can pull their own weight. And this isn't really commercial radio. You know, you're not deluged with commercials every 3 minutes. You maybe get one commercial every 15 minutes, and half of them are public service announcements just to give me a chance to go get a glass of water.
Well, Hal, I know there's a lot of obstacles to get a game going like this, but it's absolutely essential that you and others are speaking out, circumventing, sidelining the establishment media, because we just do not hear through the regular media a lot of important information that just is absolutely crucial to the survival of our society and our world. And I'm very glad you're on the air doing what you're doing. Of course, when you relaunch anything, it's going to take a time to work out some of the kinks and work out some of the problems. But, you know, I wish you well, and hope the show's a success in the future.
You know, I would say to you that because this radio show and the other shows that are on this little Internet network are constantly in flux, we're changing, we're growing. If the Institute ever wanted to have a weekly radio show, or if the Institute ever wanted to broadcast its conferences live, my network would be willing to do that.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Hal. That's something we can talk about then later.
Now, you mentioned that you have conferences, you do a lot of work on the Internet. What kind of statistics were you getting on your site before this big to-do with The Nation magazine, and how have they improved now?
Well, there seems to be a big increase in traffic on our site for several reasons, but probably the most important is that several months ago we revamped the site. We made it a lot more professional looking, more in keeping with the way user friendly or viewer friendly sites tend to be, and there's been a steady increase in hits and viewership ever since then, and I'm sure it's going to grow because the Internet has just changed the dynamics everywhere, all around the world, of reaching people.
It certainly has.
Also, we just in the last few months, for the first time, have had any kind of audio capability on our website, and that's going to be expanded as well. But there's a lot more work that needs to be done, not only on our site, but on some other sites that we run and control as well to extend our outreach.
Now, let me present to you a situation, and you know, let's carry this forward hypothetically. Let's say that folks want to learn about this point of view, want to decide for themselves whether what they were taught growing up is accurate or whether what's being presented from the IHR is accurate. And they review the information and they say, wow, look at this. I've been lied to in a big way. What should folks do to try to spread the word, carry the message, make this a political issue, or do something to change the climate of political correctness and the stifling of free speech on this topic?
Well, I'm going to be blatantly self-promoting here and urge people to help our work by sending in money to help us reach more people. That's one more. That's an obvious thing. We depend tremendously on donations from supporters, from friends, from people who wish us well and want us to reach more people. That's an obvious thing. The other thing, of course, is to take selected items and so forth, however you see fit, and send them off and forward them by email to friends and other people who might be interested.
Well, now, take, for instance, certain groups that are met with similar hostility. Let's say the National Alliance. It is basically a racialist group, a white nationalist group. They have on their website leaflets, flyers, that the general public or their members can download, print, take to a photocopy place, run off 500 copies, and distribute in the neighborhood. Do you folks do something like that?
Something like that. If you go onto a website and you go onto the icon marked leaflets, we have a number of leaflets that are readily downloadable and can download and distribute to others. Now, they're not in PDF format, so you can take them to a print shop and reprint, but you can order printed copies of them directly from us, or you can download them and send them by email, or you can download them and reformat them and print them yourself. But that's we don't have them in PDF format as some organizations do, but we do have a select set of leaflets that are meant as kind of icebreakers or introductory essays on important topics that are under leaflets on our website.
All right, great. Now, for those who aren't too keen on the internet, for folks who prefer to do things in writing or by phone.
Well, we also offer everything by regular mail as well. And people who are interested can write to us at Post Office Box 2739, Post Office Box 2739 in Newport Beach, California, 92659. And we'll send you a sample of material and catalog and other items that will be a good introduction.
Now, see, I didn't have pen and paper ready, and I don't know how many other people were out there who were going, oh, no, he's saying the address. Oh, no, I don't have a pen.
I'll be sure to give it at the end of the program.
Yes,
how about that?
Please do. Is there a phone number that folks can call?
Yes. You can reach us by phone at 949-631-1490, and you can find the phone number through our website as well, although we don't discourage people from calling, but we don't encourage it either, because we don't want to be inundated with people calling just to tell us, did you see this article that appeared in my local newspaper? I mean, that sort of thing happens all the time, too.
Been there, done that.
Yes.
It's the website, www.ihr.org.
Org, yes. I wanted to go back, if I could, Hal, to some of the other topics that were addressed at our conference.
Yes.
I talked about the Zindel case,
sure,
which was addressed by Paul Fromm. The speaker after that was a man named Chuck Carlson, and he has an organization in Arizona called We Hold These Truths. His main point in his address was to explain how it is that in the United States there's a large number of evangelical Christians who support Israel. Now, this is amazing because around the world, almost all prominent Christian groups, and even most of the major Christian groups here in this country, are rather critical of Israel, if for no other reason than that Israel's oppression of Palestinians is not merely against those who are Muslim, but also those who are Christian. Very few people know that a substantial minority of the Palestinian population are Christians, and they're in fact the descendants of the original converts to Christianity from Jesus' time or from Paul. But anyway, there is, though, in this country, a large number of evangelical Christians who support Israel, and they do so because they have interpreted the Bible to mean that the state of Israel has to be supported at all costs. Anyway, Chuck Carlson, in his address, explained how that came about, and he focused on the importance of the Scofield Bible. It's the Scofield Learning Bible, which has a lot of commentary on the Old and New Testament by a man who was very pro Jewish and who, excuse me, who, and this Bible has become a standard text in Southern Baptist and evangelical seminaries and so forth across the United States. Anyway, it's a very, very useful and interesting talk. And again, that talk can be heard by going on to the IHR website as well. Then we had another speaker, a man named Edgar Steele. He's a lawyer in Idaho who writes essays and has a website. And his talk was a very spirited, fervent address in favor of free speech. And he got a very warm reception from the audience. The other speaker after that was Bradley Smith, who I've known for years. He's spoken at a number of IHR meetings. And he talked about his work talking to students on college campuses. In fact, just a few days before, he had spoken to a small group at a California State University branch in Northern California. And, well, anyway, maybe I'll go on after that.
Yes, please. We've got to take a little break. You know, these 15-minute segments, they are actually lengthy, but they go fast.
Yep.
So I'm going to grab a cup of water. I'm going to give the phone number. Hopefully folks will call in, and we'll pick it up with you on the other side of this break. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Hal Turner Show, live from New York, New York, USA. Phone lines are all open, 201-348-8449. And I'm back, 31 minutes past the hour, here on the East Coast of the United States. You're listening to the Hal Turner Show. I'm here every Monday to Friday night, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. That's GMT minus 5 hours for those of you around the world. My guest tonight, Mark Weber, from the Institute for Historical Review. The telephone number to dial if you'd like to speak to me or to Mr. Weber, 201-348-8449. Again, that's 201-348-8449. Mark, thanks for hanging in there.
Yes, you're welcome.
You know, you mentioned earlier that you're not usually on a radio show for 2 hours. I imagine sometimes if you're on the mainstream media, they do everything they can to attack you, discredit you, and hang up on you.
Well, it depends on the show, really, and the circumstances. I have sometimes been on for a good bit of time. I was a guest years ago on the Montel Williams television show with some others for quite a long time. I was interviewed a year ago for national television in Canada on the Zindel case and on radio, too. But those are just brief clips having to do with news. I've been on a guest on quite a few talk shows, but that varies, too, from case to case.
Sure.
Sometimes they're friendly, sometimes they're not friendly. But I find over the past several years that the number of people who agree with the points I make has grown a great deal. There's much less resistance to the points I make than used to be the case. I think there is, across America and around the world, a much greater awareness than was the case just a few years ago about a lot of the points that you've raised and I've raised on this show this evening.
Well, you know, when I first started this endeavor, I never intended it to drive a stake through the heart of political correctness. I had noticed after the Oklahoma City bombing that talk radio had become sanitized. It had become pablum. It had become boring. And I wanted to offer folks an outlet where they could regain the freedom that talk radio once afforded everyone. And as I said, it's had its ups and downs, but hopefully, and then with this relaunch of the Hal Turner Show, and with guests like yourself, eloquent, educated speakers with important information, hopefully we can bring this into an environment, into a listenership that will give the mainstream a real run for its money. You know, Nielsen Ratings recently reported that the network television news, ABC, NBC, CBS, had lost 40% of their viewers in the last 2 years. Those folks are out there, they're thirsting for other information. They're thirsting, craving new sources of information. And you know, this is a golden time, a golden opportunity for folks like you and folks like me to build on that and get the proper information out so that people can make informed choices.
Well, that's why, especially the opportunities presented by the war in Iraq, because millions of people everywhere around across in America and around the world see the contradiction between the claims that we were given by our government just a year ago to justify this war and the reality that we now see. Promises were made that have been broken, pledges were made that have been broken, and especially at a time of war, people want to know, how did we get into this situation? What's going on?
Sure.
It's very important to be skeptical, especially in wartime, because especially at that, in times of crisis, governments try to keep people in line by telling them things that's going to be keeping their policies in line. But something is really out of connect here. Something is really out of kilter, and more people see it, I think. And to understand the whole overall picture requires an understanding of the past. And in that regard, I think the role of the IHR is a very important one.
Yeah, I remember when we were first talking about attacking Iraq. I said early on, I voted for George Bush, I'm a registered Republican, and attacking Iraq is the wrong thing to do. Whether or not they have weapons of mass destruction is none of our business because they're a sovereign country, and sovereign countries have weapons of mass destruction. More importantly, even if they had weapons of mass destruction, they were no threat to the United States of America. But I noticed that they were a threat to a certain other country. In fact, I noticed that the Iraqi leader had repeatedly threatened to amass a 7-million-man army on the border between Iraq and Jordan, and at some point to cross into Jordan and go attack Israel. And lo and behold, the U.S. election happens in 2000. Strangely enough, September 11th attacks occur, and 1, 2, 3, we attack Afghanistan. Next stop, Iraq. It was like a freight train, and all the rhetoric that was used to justify the war was wrong when it was being first espoused. I objected to it when it was first espoused, and lo and behold, here we are. What, almost a year after the invasion of Iraq? I've been proven right. There were no weapons of mass destruction. The whole premise for the war was a lie.
Well, I've dealt with this subject at some length in several talks that I've given recently. What is the real reason for this war? It's obvious that the reasons given by our president and by the administration are not true, but what is the real reason for this war? Well, I'm not the only one, but you'll find this information on a lot of other websites like antiwar.com. And many other sites that lay out that the cabal, a small group of men in high levels of the Bush administration, were bent on war with Iraq long before Bush was even president.
Sure.
And long before September 11. These people call themselves or have been called neoconservatives.
Yes.
But they're people who have a strong loyalty and ties to Israel. And it's a remarkable thing, a damning thing, really, the footprints that they left behind showing their determination to go to war and to get this country to go to war against Iraq, not for American interests, but for Israeli interests. And I've quoted a number of times this thing. In August 2002, that is in the months leading up to the war, General Wesley Clark was interviewed by The Guardian. That's a leading British daily newspaper. And in this interview, Clark, you might remember, was a Democratic Party candidate for president. He's former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. And this is what he said during this interview. He said, quote, "Those who favor this attack, that is by the United States against Iraq now, will tell you candidly and privately that it is probably true that Saddam Hussein is no threat to the United States, but they are afraid at some point he might decide, if he had a nuclear weapon, to use it against Israel," unquote. And it's very clear that, and this has been confirmed by any number of people, and the evidence that comes to light with each passing month further confirms that this war was pushed for, cajoled, prodded for by people who had an agenda very different than the one that the president proclaimed and very different than the interests of the American people.
I often find myself wondering, is George Bush a useful idiot, or is he merely being prevented from getting other input because, as president, he is kept in a cocoon?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm often perplexed myself about actually what makes this man tick. He seems, as many observers have said, just about the most uncurious, unimaginative president we've had in many years. He says he doesn't read books. He doesn't read newspapers. He says he relies for objective information of all things from his staff, for heaven's sakes. I mean, that's a very dangerous situation when the most powerful man in the world is one who exists in this kind of self-imposed ghetto. And he seems to be a man who is unable to admit when he makes a mistake or unable to draw conclusions from policies when they don't turn out the way he said. But one of the things that's very obvious is that if he was really just simply misled and wasn't himself a part of all of this, he would have punished those, or at least fired or disciplined those people who supposedly misled him. But no one's been fired.
I know.
From his staff. If somebody had really fed him a false line and he knew, and he later found out that he was misled, you'd think his anger and his indignation would be tremendous.
Well, sure, because as the most powerful man in the world, in a political sense, he will have been made a fool of by this wrong information.
Well, not only made a fool of, but have cost the lives of hundreds of Americans and billions of dollars. But
not to mention,
the most remarkable thing is the silence from the White House exactly in that regard. No one's been called to the carpet. Nobody's been fired as a result of supplying of information that's proven to be false. And it leads one almost inescapably to the conclusion that Bush himself knew that what he was saying at the time was not true. It's not a question of false information. It's a question of hitting on a policy, aiming for a policy, and then just trying to find some sort of evidence somehow cobbled together to support and justify a policy that he had already set his eye on.
I'll tell you, Mark, we've got someone on the phone once again in on here. Let me go to the telephones. Thank you for holding. You're on the Hal Turner Show. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Yeah, Hal, Tony down in Fort Lauderdale.
Tony in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I just want to compliment Mr. Weber on his new website there. I was cruising it, and it's looking very, very good.
Well, thank you very much. I'll pass on the compliment to our webmaster who handles that.
I'm sure that drives the ADL and the Simon Wiesenthal Center out of their minds.
Well, they're angry when, as I say, when even a blade of grass starts poking up between the cracks in the concrete. But they are, you know, the story of the little Dutch boy who's got his finger in the dike because the dike is breaking. They've got a lot of cracks in the dike all over the world right now. And sites like the IHR site and shows like this one are doing a lot to create more sleepless nights among the in the ADL crowd.
Anyway, you know, I was at an event a few weeks ago, and luckily some guy printed up about 50 copies of Did 6 Million Really Die?
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard of that, you know, booklet for quite a while. Seen it advertised, I never read it. So I got a copy of it, obviously came back. I read it. I was quite impressed with it. And my question to you, Mark, is do you feel that's a good piece of literature, you know, to give someone as an introduction to revision, you know, to revisionism? And also, you know, what's your opinion on the factual information in that booklet? I understand there's a lot of versions of it, but did you feel that pretty well sums, revisionism up?
It's interesting you should ask me about that. I was on the stand in 1988 as a witness precisely for much of the time to deal precisely with that booklet. I was taken by the attorney for Zindel in the case line by line through virtually the entire text of that book and asked to comment on it. I was qualified as an expert witness on World War II history and the Holocaust, and went through the booklet in that regard. But the booklet does contain errors. It was written pretty hastily years ago in England, and it relies a lot on secondary literature. There's a lot more that has been published in the years since the booklet first appeared in the 70s to confirm or to clarify a lot of the points made in the booklet. The booklet's a useful introduction, but it's only an introduction. And you'll find a lot more substantial and up-to-date information in items that we've published over the years since then, both in our journal and elsewhere, and you can find it on our website. But it is a good eye-opening booklet. Again, it's by no means perfect, if for no other reason than that so much more has come out in the years since it was first published.
Yeah, it definitely opened my eyes, and I'll definitely check out some of the some of the books on your site, because I'd like to delve into this issue a little, you know, in much greater depth than in that booklet. But I think that's a very good eye opener for people that, you know, believe the 6 million lie.
Great. Well, you can order it through through our website or the related website, and we're glad to hear from you.
Okay. Thanks.
All right, we're going to take one final break, and we'll be back with more of Mark Weber from the Institute for Historical Review. Give us a call, 201-348-8449. And we're back, the final 15 minutes of the relaunch of the Hal Turner Show, Monday, May 3, 2004. I want to remind all of you that immediately following tonight's program will be the weekly airing of the Holla Hoax with Mona Montgomery from Glendale, California. That'll be on from 11 to midnight Eastern Time. We had a very successful kickoff too this morning of our newest program, The Free American, Voice of Liberty, with the host Clay Douglas. That's the newest addition to the Turner Radio Network, and that's on Monday to Friday from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern U.S. time, right here on TurnerRadioNetwork.com. Let's get back to my guest, Mr. Mark Weber. Mark, you've been a real trooper over the last hour and 47 minutes.
Ron, it's a pleasure to be on a show like this, Hal.
Well, thanks very much. I guess that I should tell folks to get pen and paper ready in case they want to get the mailing address, perhaps to make a donation, perhaps to, if they haven't already, because you've mentioned a number of times, they can copy down your website address, and perhaps, again, your phone number.
Yes, the postal address that I promised earlier is Post Office Box 2739, 2739, Newport Beach, California, 92659. You can reach us by phone at 949-631-1490. And our website address, again, is www.ihr.org.
Now, I had to write fast for that, so let me make sure I got it correct, okay? Mailing address is the Institute for Historical Review. Post Office Box 2739, Newport Beach, California, 92659. Telephone number is 949-631-1490, and the website, www.ihr.org.
That's right, Hal. Thank you.
Well, thank you. What does the future hold for the IHR, I mean the immediate future? What are the goals for the rest
of
this year?
Well, we just have to keep building, and we have some book projects for publication lined up. We have some more outreach lined up. We need more money. Our staff needs to be expanded. But above all, crucial for this is money and financial support, and that's what we appeal for. But in a larger way, success not only for the IHR in a narrow way, but for all of us, is measured by two things. First of all, our own enthusiasm and dedication and commitment for the sake not only of our country but for the world to do whatever we can. And second of all, to reach as many new people as possible. It's not enough to talk to those people who already agree with us. We've got to reach people who don't already understand what we're trying to say. And that's our great goal. And I think that the IHR is a lot more positioned now, better positioned now than it has been to do exactly those two things.
Well, Mark, is there anything that we didn't cover tonight that you had hoped to talk about?
Well, yes. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that we could talk about, and perhaps on another occasion we can do that. But, around the world, something is really changing. There's a growing awareness about the issues that we talked about throughout this show this evening. And the relationship between an understanding of the past and where we are in the present and the future is just absolutely crucial. And that's our main goal. And we will not act unless we know that we're acting in a way that's truthful and grounded in reality. And it's important in that regard to have the kind of, you might say, intellectual arsenal that's required to act in for what's good and right and proper.
Well, I am very much pleased that you chose to be a guest on the program. I'm very grateful that you spent just about the whole 2 hours. I have some other topics that I need to talk about before the end of the show, and since there's only 10 minutes left, would you mind terribly if I thanked you for being a part of the program and invited you back to come again?
Yeah, it'd be an honor. It'd be a pleasure. And I understand completely, and I wish you well. And working out the show on the new format and the relaunched Hal Turner show in the months and years to come.
Mark Weber, thanks so very much. You've been a great guest. I hope I made you feel welcome. I hope you come back.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Mr. Mark Weber from the Institute for Historical Review, www.ihr.org.